Women and Film 2018, one of the festivals presented by the Port Townsend Film Festival for our community. It happens April 14th and 15th in four venues around Port Townsend. Welcome to one of our interview programs with directors of these films. On this program, we'll be hearing about the film Proof of Loyalty, Kazuo Yamane and the Nisei Soldiers of Hawaii. And we'll be hearing about a film entitled Missing in Europe.
You're going to tell me where my daughter is?
It's nearly impossible to trace these people. They have friends everywhere, including the police. How are you in so fast?
I used to be a hacker. Now I teach. It's a long story.
We're speaking with Tamar Halpern, writer and director, who will be in Port Townsend for Women in Film on April 14th and 15th for the screening of her sixth feature, Missing in Europe. Tamar lives in Los Angeles, has adapted three books and two life stories for film. She's won multiple awards for her wide-ranging work, including the Boston Women in Comedy Award, and she was selected as the 2016-17 American Film Showcase Film Expert for the U.S. Department of Education and the USC School of Cinematic Arts. She's also taught filmmaking and screenwriting in Amman, Jordan. I'm sure that's a whole other story. And she received her MFA in film production from USC. And she also spent precious time at Hedgebrook on Whidbey Island. Hedgebrook, for those that don't know, is a funded writing retreat for women to gather to effect change through their writing. Tamar Halpern, welcome to KPTZ and to Port Townsend.
Thank you, and thank you for mentioning Hedgebrook. That experience, I got to go as a writer in 97, and then I returned in 2010, and it's just been huge life-changing events in my life to have the time and space to go there and write and be taken care of. It's one of the best nonprofit organizations supporting women that I know of.
It sounds like it was the best deep breath that you ever took.
Just an incredible experience. And I know the applications open up in June for the following year. So I encourage all women writers who are listening to apply.
Well, listen, there's so much to talk about and so little time by comparison, considering your fascinating journey as an artist. But we want to talk about your film, Missing in Europe. First, I have to ask, what were the influences in your life that led you to writing and cinema as an expression of art?
Oh, a couple influences in terms of just the writing. My grandmother, Sylvia, my mom's mom, wrote. I often heard the typewriter tapping away, and she wrote two books that she never published, but she was really dedicated to doing. And so, of course, I got to play on her typewriter as a little girl. And my mother is a visual artist, so I think she really opened me up to seeing things visually. I was a big reader as a kid, and my father took me every weekend to see movies in the 70s, which meant I saw a lot of films that by today's standards probably kids shouldn't see, but I had this incredible cinematic relationship with the screen by seeing everything that was made in the 70s and 80s. Also, one night a week on the weekends, we'd saw theater. So storytelling is just been a part of my life. My son, who's now grown up, is a composer for film and television. So it's just sort of the gift has kept giving, writing music for my son, for myself, writing stories. And I also write short fiction. So I've had a couple pieces published there as well. So I just love to write.
And one of the things that I noticed when I saw the screening of Missing in Europe, I noticed that color and texture seem to be an important part of your work. And there's a definite visual style to Missing in Europe, some very vibrant colors. And I'm wondering if previous projects had influenced your approach to this film, you know, namely your 7-year experience with Lynn Fowlkes, the one. and for those listeners that are not familiar with Lynn Fowlkes, the title of the film was Lynn Fowlkes' One Man Band. It was this wonderful story, wonderful study of a very driven and nonconformist Los Angeles artist and painter. So, did that whole experience, and I know you weren't filming constantly over a 7-year period, but did he have an influence on you and your take on texture and color?
Probably. I mean, he must have, having spent so much time around his paintings. I do want to mention that Lynn is a Washington native. He's from Yakima.
Oh, that's
so
right.
So he's one of your own, even though he moved to Los Angeles in the 60s. But I'm very proud of that documentary. It's the only documentary I've ever made, and it was a side project. But in a lot of ways, I feel like it's the film that most people have seen. Well, maybe maybe not now that I'm making films that end up on Lifetime because they have a huge audience, but until I started doing thrillers, which Missing in Europe is the first of three that I'm about to embark on my third thriller for them in 2 weeks. My documentary made it on Netflix. It had a theatrical release. It just was renewed for a second year on Netflix, so you can still see it there, plus Amazon and iTunes. And I feel like that documentary came out of probably being raised by my mother, the artist Abigail Gumbiner, and having this deep respect for people who work with their hands, and also being fascinated with Lin as a musician and a painter. And I think the textures and his commitment to making something new in painting, something that had never been seen before, and actually achieving it, inspired me, because most of the time I was filming him, no one cared what he was doing. So it was also an inspiration for me that I can keep writing and making films, and maybe someday people will care about what I'm doing. But it shouldn't stop me from not doing it.
And he was unabashedly unafraid to tear something down and build it back up again. It was
fascinating.
Yes. It was fascinating to watch that whole odyssey over a 7-year period.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for watching it. And it's interesting. I think Variety actually said it had an air of a queasy thriller. So in a way, I learned the structure of sort of telling a story in a way where there are twists and turns through the documentary about Lin. And then I've been able to put that to the test doing these thrillers that I've been doing lately.
Well, talk about twists and turns. Let's talk about the feature film you'll be bringing to Port Townsend. And it's titled,
okay,
it's titled Missing in Europe, or My Daughter is Missing. Tell me about these titles. How did this all happen?
So the way it happened is it was originally called Missing in Europe when we were in production and post. And then Lifetime bought the domestic rights, and Lifetime likes to rename films. So they renamed it My Daughter's Missing. They really like to have sort of titles that explain what the movie is, because it helps people pick which film they want to watch, which makes sense. And then it was released internationally under the title The Disappeared. So it actually has three titles. And I mean, it's all beyond me, but Missing in Europe is what we called it and how we shot it. And I believe there's even a trailer out there for Missing in Europe. So I don't really know what the official title is anymore.
Background for our listeners. Here's sort of like a summary of what happens in this movie. There's an American cybersecurity expert. Her name is Sarah Woods, and she's in Belgrade, Serbia. She arrives under the guise of attending a work conference, but is primarily there to visit with her daughter, who is studying abroad. And when Sarah's daughter and classmate are kidnapped by a human trafficking ring, Sarah races to locate her daughter. Now, this is filmed on location in Belgrade, and Sarah actually, over the course of the film, turns out to be a kick-ass woman. I mean, as the film and the intrigue develops, did you have a model, an inspiration for this character? She's a hacker, and she's using her talent for good, for example. What was your take on this character?
Well, I didn't actually write the script. I rewrote it, uncredited.
Okay.
So the plot was pretty much there. I changed some things, like in the script I was given, the daughter and the mother both knew about the past, about the father being a hacker and using it for bad.
I see.
And so I changed that to be a revelation where Sarah feels like her daughter's old enough to know the truth about why she and her father split up. You know, things like that, just to kind of make the audience feel like they were discovering things as the characters were.
Uh-huh.
But the plot needed to stay somewhat. I also created sort of the love interest potential between Sarah and the retired police detective,
right,
who ends up helping her because he's been trying to crack the human trafficking ring in Belgrade himself. So he figures Sarah's daughter will lead him to the culprit. So he teams up with her. And it was important to me when I rewrote that she was helping him as much as he was helping her, as opposed to just he was helping her. A lot of the plots that Lifetime likes to put out in terms of the thriller genre is where good, decent women get duped and get involved in a situation that seems overwhelming and impossible to win. And because of that, sometimes the stories, the scripts I've sent, the women can feel a little bit victimized because they are innocent bystanders in a way. And then something happens that draws them into, you know, dark circumstances, and which is a great, you know, that's the makings of a thriller. But for Lifetime, what I've been getting back as feedback from the network is what they love about when I rewrite these scripts is that I remove the victim portion and add more empowerment to to the women. So that's just me breathing myself into these stories.
God bless you.
Thank you.
And this film was produced and shot in Belgrade, right? Other than the fact that you have location, 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 but how did you decide to do that? What was your experience, especially in the casting process? That fascinated me. And it seems, especially in this film, casting was critical.
Casting was critical. Casting happened incredibly quickly. So basically our producers, Kyla York, who is coming to the festival as well, and Nigel Thomas, we would go back and forth with casting lists. But because we were casting from the UK, Nigel knew a lot more of the talent pool than I did or Kyla did. So he was really good at coming up with potential lists. And we were working really quickly. And Miranda Raisin was top on our list, and so was Emmett Scanlon. So we got super lucky that they were both available and willing to just jump over to Serbia and get going. Sophie Robertson, who plays the daughter, is a new discovery. I was going through tapes that were submitted to me, and she was hands down the choice. Like, there wasn't even a close second. She was so good. And Sophie's career is about to take off. She's been cast in a BBC series. The rest of our cast came from Serbia, and I got very lucky because a friend of mine here in LA is from Belgrade, and she introduced me to her friend who's a director in the National Theater there, and he gave me a bunch of names of some really hardcore, amazing actors. Just a lot of our actors came from this pool of really serious theater actors in Serbia, and that we were able to take and bring into the movie. And then Red Productions, which was the production company in Belgrade, brought in other people for us to see as well. There's an incredible talent pool there.
Well, tomorrow we have a few minutes left, and I would be remiss if we didn't cover this subject. You know, human trafficking is something that is major in its scope, but it seems to be below the radar of most people's lives. Did you do a lot of research about the subject, and were there any ahas or experiences you encountered in the process? Lastly, what kind of an emotional impact did it have on you?
It's funny because I didn't realize how prevalent human trafficking was until I dove into this project. I was aware it was a thing. I remember seeing that great film Frozen River that had a B story about human trafficking across the border from Canada into the U.S. And I was aware it was a thing, but going and creating a story about it and then screening it for people and having people talk about it and also noticing so many more stories about human trafficking in the news, it just really opened my eyes that this is a huge issue. And I do want to say for people who are considering attending the screening, we don't get really gritty in terms of the treatment of the women who are kidnapped. So you're not going to be forced to see things that upset you necessarily. Our story deals with people who are holding the women until they can sell them into human trafficking. So I don't want anybody to not come see the film because they're concerned they'll see rape or anything like that, because we don't deal with things like that. That's not in the Lifetime mission statement in terms the things that we want to show the audience, but it certainly does exist out there. So this is sort of more of a tip of the iceberg of the middlemen trading these women to get them to their final destination. But the writer, I'm sure, did a lot of research in order to generate the plot point. For me personally, it opened my eyes up to how vulnerable women are and made me even prouder that I was making a film about a strong woman who fights back.
We're very proud that you're bringing your film to Women in Film here in Port Townsend. So be wonderful to see you in person when you get here. And folks, we've been speaking with Tamar Halpern. She's a writer and director who will be in Port Townsend for Women in Film on April 14th to 15th for the screening of her sixth feature, Missing in Europe, or The Disappeared, or...
My daughter is missing. I want to say it's screening 10 a.m. on Saturday. So
yes,
it'd be a great way to start the weekend to feel some empowerment and a little edge of your seat excitement. And I'll be there for the Q&A afterwards as well. So I really look forward to meeting people. Port Townsend is a very special place for me. I was very close friends with Sandy Diamond, who was your resident poet and playwright.
Yes.
I've known her since Hedgebrook in 1997 and have visited her often there. We'll be staying with her sister, Diane.
I play her on my show semi-regularly.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I love that woman. All right. Well, thank you so much, and we will see you very, very soon.
I so look forward to it. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the film. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tamar.
How are you doing so fast?
I used to be a hacker. Now I teach. It's a long story.
The Nisei adopted the nickname One Puka Puka for the 100th Battalion, as Puka stands for whole in Hawaiian. They trained as infantry, but hidden within their ranks was a treasure the Army was desperately looking for. men who could translate and interpret Japanese, like Kazuo Yamane.
I'm Larry Stein from KPTZ. We're covering Women and Film. The mini festival happens in April every year now as part of the Port Townsend Film Festival. And the festival's really proud of this extra festival that they've added on during April. One of the films coming up the weekend of the 14th and 15th is a film by a filmmaker who's been here a few times before at the Port Townsend Film Festival with other projects. Her name is Lucy Ostrander. She's a producer, director of many documentary films, along with her partner, Don Sellers. They often have co-directing credit. I believe on this film, you have co-directing credit. Is that right? Right. Your film is Proof of Loyalty, Kazuo Yamane and the Nisei Soldiers of Hawaii. Lucy, you and Don have really developed a kind of subspecialty in documentaries about Japanese Americans in this country, and really specifically around World War II. How did that develop? That you've sort of found a niche there in which there's an awful lot of rich material.
Yeah, well, I never set out to do this. It really started with a film that I produced back in 1986 called East of Occidental, and that was a film on the history of Asian Americans, the International District. And we focused on the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Filipino immigrants.
So when you say the International District, you mean International District in Seattle, right?
Yes, International District in Seattle. Right. Then several years later, I was commissioned by the Washington State Centennial Commission in 1988. They wanted a film on the history and contributions of Asian Americans in Washington State. And so we focused on three different multi-generational families throughout the state. Again, a Chinese-American, a Japanese-American, a Filipino-American. And I moved to Bainbridge Island in 1996. I was asked to do a film by Islandwood, which was an environmental learning center on the island. They wanted a film on the history of Port Blakely, which was, at the turn of the century, the largest lumber mill in the world. And we focused on the different people that worked at the mill. We focused on three different groups, the Native Americans, the Japanese, and the Scandinavians. And so although this was before World War II, we got to know a little bit of the history of the Japanese on Bainbridge Island.
And that leads in a certain way to this subject. I mean, I know you've had another film since then, more specifically about some Japanese Americans from Bainbridge Island.
Yeah.
And Bainbridge Island was a major, for this part of the country, a place where Japanese Americans were rounded up and taken away from their homes, really, during that awful period after Pearl Harbor.
They were exclusion order number one. It was the first community in the country where Japanese Americans were taken away. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Japanese Americans were major participants in the agricultural basis of Bainbridge Island. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, this newest film, Proof of Loyalty, Kazuo Yamane and the Nisei Soldiers of Hawaii, takes us away from Bainbridge Island to Hawaii. I assume there was some connection that got you from Bainbridge to Hawaii.
What happened was we made a film several years ago, which was shown at the Port Townsend Film Festival, called Honor and Sacrifice, the Roy Matsumoto Stories. And that film was on public television. And after it was broadcast, I got a phone call from a woman in Edmonds named Joyce Yamane. And she had seen the film, and she really liked it. And she started to tell me about her father's story and asked if we might be interested in making a film about her father. And we didn't know much about the history of the Japanese Americans in Hawaii and started to research the story and found it fascinating and one that we thought we should make a film about.
I think we are all very, sadly, very familiar now, and I'm glad it's out in the open, but it's such a sad story. But all of us in the Northwest here are familiar with the internment camps that took Japanese American citizens out of especially the west coast of the United States, and of course heavily the Northwest, and took them and put them in these dreadful camps. We're not that familiar with the differences with the Japanese Americans in Hawaii, who have a real kind of different history that's illuminated by your film.
That's right. And in fact, we showed the film at the Hawaii International Film Festival in November, and so many people came up to us afterwards, not only to thank us for making the film, but they said, you know, we just didn't know this story. If it's not known in Hawaii, it's certainly not known on the mainland.
And it's a story really worth knowing. There are some rumblings in people's general knowledge about Nisei soldiers serving in U.S. services during World War II. What's interesting that you learn from your film is how heavily represented the Japanese Americans of Hawaii were in that group.
That's right. You know, we think our film is particularly timely for the political situation our country is in today, because the two main themes of the film are the importance of diversity and the importance of the language of immigrants.
Speaking of language of immigrants, I mean, what another really enlightening thing for a Haole here, someone who's not a Hawaiian, is the importance of the local language really that got developed by the many immigrant communities in Hawaii, what they call Pidgin now.
And yes.
That was a key important thing for these Japanese American men who joined the services.
And that's one of the areas of the film that we found particularly fascinating, was the fact that in 1924, the territory of Hawaii created a two-tiered public education system. They had schools called English Standard Schools. And even though these were public schools, these public schools had the better teachers and the better facilities. And in order to get into these English Standard Schools, students had to pass an oral English exam. And most of the non-white population spoke Pidgin, this Hawaiian Creole English. And so this is a way that language was used to discriminate against the people of color. And yet, during the war, when there were soldiers such as Kazuo Yamane, who could speak fluent Japanese and read Japanese, he became essential in helping to win the war against Japan.
And they spent a lot of time in the battlefield in Europe also.
That was enlightening to realize
that they weren't just in the Pacific theater.
That's right. Well, the 100th Battalion, which started in Hawaii, became the precursor to the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was an all-volunteer Nisei combat team, the most highly decorated combat team in military history. And they fought with great valor throughout Europe during the war.
You talk about language, though. An interesting thing that I found about Kazuo Yamane is that he, along with many Japanese young people who grew up in Hawaii, was sent back to Japan by his family to really make sure he learned Japanese.
Yes. The parents of these, the first generation, the Issei, made their kids go to Japanese language school after school, which they absolutely hated, and most of them didn't really learn Japanese. But it was important for them, that even though they wanted them very much to be Americans, they wanted them to learn the culture of their parents and their grandparents. And Kazuo went after graduating from high school in Honolulu. He spent 5 years at Waseda University, which was considered the Harvard of Japan, and became fluent in Japanese. Was also required to have military training.
That's right.
This is between 1935 and 1940, and returned to Hawaii on the second of the last ship before the Pearl Harbor attack.
Wow, yeah, because there was a certain tension there in terms of whether he, as a Japanese-American from Hawaii studying in Japan, would be conscripted to fight for Japan.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
These young students who were sent back to Japan were aware of the kind of gathering clouds, as they say, and they had to make sure that they were not in the wrong place.
And some of them were.
Yeah.
Some of them were.
Well, it's really wonderful for those of us, everybody who on the West Coast who loves Hawaii. It's a wonderful bit of history about Hawaii. And it's a wonderful bit of enriching our history of the Japanese Americans in our communities. Because I grew up on the West Coast between Los Angeles and here in Seattle. And we're aware of Japanese Americans where we grew up. But the story in Hawaii is so different. There's so many similarities, but yet it's such a unique difference.
You're right. Yeah. There was after the Pearl Harbor attack, martial law was declared, and they did round up some of the leaders of the Japanese American community, and some were sent to the mainland to be incarcerated. Some were incarcerated in Hawaii, but there was no mass incarceration like the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Well, the film, I think the film speaks for itself. It has some wonderful archival footage and photographs. I mean, you must have spent many, many hours combing through archives to find this imagery.
Yeah, well, most of the archival footage came from a film that was shot by John Ford.
Oh, yeah, one of those famous...
The cinematographer was Greg Toland.
The famous Hollywood people going back to contribute to the war effort.
Right. Yeah. So we were very fortunate to have that footage because it's amazing stuff. It's
And then the still images are amazing bits of history. So I'm sure that comes from archives in Hawaii, I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, we're really happy to be able to get a chance to see this film. This is the first time in Port Townsend anybody can see this film, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And we're looking forward to being there.
And you'll be there. So Proof of Loyalty will screen on Sunday morning at 10 a.m. in the Starlight Room, the wonderful plush Starlight Room, a great place to watch movies, along with another film with a military theme called Sounds of Freedom, directed by Holly Chadwick. I believe all of you filmmakers will be there. Give us the name of the film again. Make sure we get the names correctly.
Proof of Loyalty, Kazuo Yamane and the Nisei Soldiers of Hawaii.
New film by Lucy Ostrander and Don Sellers, repeat visitors to the Port Townsend Film Festival. We met them several years ago representing other films that they've brought. And I assume there'll be others coming down the pike that we'll be seeing in years to come.
I hope so.
I assume you have some stuff in the works right now.
In the works.
Yeah. I mean, the life of a documentary filmmaker, it's like a lot is happening or it's a lot of waiting. So,
Right.
Lucy Ostrander, director with Don Sellers of Proof of Loyalty, Kazuo Yamane and the Nisei Soldiers of Hawaii. We'll see you here at the film festival on Sunday at 10 a.m. for a screening in the Starlight Room. Thanks for taking time to talk to me.
Oh, thanks for taking the time to interview me. I appreciate it.
One day, Mr. Yamane opened a crate of captured documents. It had been shipped all the way to Camp Ritchie, marked no military value. He opened up the crate, reached into the documents, and he found one document, and he opened it up and was surprised to see it was published minutes of a meeting that had been held in the spring of 1944 among all the key leaders of the Japanese armaments industry.
Women and Film 2018, a presentation of Port Townsend Film Festival for our community. You've heard interviews with Lucy Ostrander, the director of Proof of Loyalty, Kazuo Yamane and the Nisei Soldiers of Hawaii, and Tamar Halperin, the director of Missing in Europe. Interviews for Women and Film 2018 are produced by Chris Bricker, Chris Wilson, and me, Larry Stein. The project is inspired, of course, by our longtime collaborator, Marcia Perlstein, to whom Women in Film 2018 is dedicated. Thank you, Marcia. I'm Larry Stein. Thanks for being with us. Enjoy the film festival.